Wahino am Adonai Eloheinu alenu ma'aseh deno kunana alenu ma'aseh deno kunanehu. This continues our recording.
Eliyahu says to the prophets of Baal, choose for yourself the one bull, prepare it, since you're the majority, you call in the name of your deity, but don't put any fire. Come on, let's do things and see what happens. He's going to say, let's see how spiritual you guys really are. They took the bull, they prepared it, and called upon the name of their Baal from morning until noon. Oh, Baal, answer us! Obviously, no voice, no answer. They hopped on their altar that they made. In other words, they were trying all of their, in quotes, meditative methods and techniques to try to create a supernatural reality. And it didn't work. About noontime, Eliyahu started to mock them. And he goes, oh, you better call with a louder voice. You know, maybe God's hard of hearing. Maybe he's out. He's on a journey. Maybe he's sleeping and you need to awake. Needless to say, the mocking of your enemies at your most desperate hour is not something very nice. But Eliyahu here is a man of zeal, a man of passion. Just like Pinchas, if you remember the son of Eliezer, the son of Aharon a Kohen. And indeed, many people in the Midrash state that Pinchas was extended with such great long life and longevity that indeed Eliyahu is Pinchas. Now, whether he was physically or whether he was spiritually, topic of another time. But here, Eliyahu mocks them and says, you emasculated fools. You have no power. There's nothing you can do. You don't have what it takes. So, they continued to call in a loud voice. They gashed themselves, as was their custom, with swords and lances until blood gushed out. Indeed, for those of you who know the powers of the occult and black magic, by the shedding of their blood in a state of frenzy, they were endeavoring to arouse certain types of spiritual elements that, if you will, nourish themselves on human blood, to come and to intervene and physically create the fire that would thus silence Eliyahu. And indeed, entities of this nature do truly exist and do have the power to act in this way. And indeed, by this offering of blood, would have responded like that. Except that they were going up against Eliyahu HaNavi. And Eliyahu HaNavi would not even allow the psychic arena to be inhabited by these entities. They were, in essence, forced and blocked out. They could not come and create the artificial reality, which, unfortunately, is all too many times created elsewhere. As the afternoon passed, they were feigning in prophecy, trying to get something going. Obviously, nothing was happening. Eliyahu says to the people, come near to me. All the people came near, and he repaired the torn-down altar of Hashem. This is the altar originally created by Shaul HaMelech himself, it states. Now, understand here a very profound point. From the time of the building of the Beit HaMikdash, the Halakha stated that it was forbidden to offer any sacrifices to Hashem outside of Jerusalem. This altar, which even though it was built by Shaul HaMelech, was not meant to be rebuilt. Eliyahu HaNavi was indeed, in essence, violating a law of the Torah. But here we have what's called Hora'at Sha'ah, the authority of a prophet that for the sake of the greater Kiddush Hashem, can actually temporarily suspend a specific mitzvah to fulfill a greater one. And this is exactly what Eliyahu HaNavi was doing. Obviously, he wasn't going to be able to bring all the people down to Yerushalayim, so he specifically went to the altar torn down that was originally built by a king of Israel. He took 12 stones corresponding to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of Hashem said, Yisrael shall be your name. In other words, he is now creating a vortex of the collective consciousness of the entire Jewish people. He built the stones in an altar in the name of Hashem, in essence imbuing it with this psychic spiritual energy of the name. And he made a trench. as great as would contain 2 seah of seed around the altar. He arranged the wood and cut up the bull and placed it on the wood. And then he said, bring me 4 pitchers of water, pour it all over the burnt offerings and on the wood. In other words, make sure that no one's going to accuse me of having a secret spark of fire inside here. And he goes, do it again. He did it again. Do it a third time. He did it a third time. And the water went around the altar, and also the trench he filled with water. And it was the time of the mincha sacrifice. That this was the time that Eliyahu Navi came and said, Hashem, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, today let it be known that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and at your word have I done all these things. Answer me, Hashem, answer me. Aneini, Hashem, aneini. It's words that we recite in prayer to this day. And the people shall know that you are Hashem, you are their God, and that you have turned their hearts backwards. A fire of Hashem fell upon it and consumed the burnt offerings. The wood and the stones and the water which was in the trench, it licked up. Indeed, Eliyahu did not offer just a bull. The pouring of the water served a double purpose. Not only was it a means to show there was no fire in there, but it was also, if you will, an offering to Hashem himself. That the time of the famine, remember, was going on now. 4 pitchers of water, 2, 3, you know, times. That's 12 pitchers of water. Water was of tremendous value here. And Eliyahu again was saying, don't worry about it. There's no such thing as limitation. Give it to Hashem too. And this was his means of ending the famine and to bring the rain, as we will see. Eliyahu, as we will see, was to call for rain. So he gave Hashem the water. We'll learn more as we continue. All the people saw, fell on their faces, and said, Hashem is Elohim, Hashem is Elohim. Remember, Elohim is a generic name for God. Everybody believes in God, but not everybody is willing to accept that God, who revealed himself on Mount Sinai and gave his Torah to his chosen people Israel, is the true God, creator of heaven and the earth. Everybody in the world wants to call God by a different name. The great sanctification and making holy of God's name is that people recognize what it is that God has truly done, who he truly is, and who he is not. And Eliyahu says, as a means of making peace amongst the Jewish people, to make everybody understood and everybody understanding in a spirit of love and brotherhood, he reaches out to embrace the prophets of Baal, and he says, seize the prophets of Baal, let no one escape. They seized them. Eliyahu took them down to the brook and killed every last one of them. And it is in their blood that the people recognized they were deceived, that this was a lie. And Eliyahu then says to Ahab, who apparently was there, go up now, leave this place, eat and drink, for you will now hear the rumbling sound of rain. And Ahab went up to eat and drink, because Eliyahu told him, and Ahab is no fool. He does listen to Eliyahu. And now Eliyahu goes up to the top of Mount Carmel. There was the altar down at the side. Now he goes up to the top. And it says here, he crouched on the ground, put his head between his knees, and says to his servant, go up, please, and look towards the sea. And he went and he looked and he said, nothing there. And he said, go again. And he goes back and forth 7 times. Each time, nothing there. And then the 7th time, the final time, he says, you know, there's a small cloud coming, size of a man's palm, rising from the sea. What on earth is going on here? This is how you bring rain? All Eliyahu Navi just brought down fire from heaven. Why can't he just bring rain from heaven? Raise up his hands and say, Hashem, sanctify your name, bring rain. And all of a sudden, the rain should fall. Didn't happen that way. Why? because Eliyahu HaNavi is bringing the rain. He, using the power of Hashem, being the vessel of Hashem, is creating the rain. So he goes up to the top of the mountain, crouches to the ground, puts his head between his knees. What is all this? What is that? This is known as the position of the prophet. It is a meditative technique that is used in the prophetic Kabbalah, and I'll explain it to you now. The position is such. One would come and get down on one's knees and then sit with one's rear on one's feet, and then completely prostrate oneself to the ground, wherein which one's face would fall down almost on top of one's knees. One's torso would be on top of the legs. Your face would be to the ground. You're completely as if folded down now. Your hands have to be at your side with your elbows touching or being right next to the side of your knees. Your fingers must be completely open and stretched out, with the palms opposite your mouth, with your forehead touching the ground. This is the position that you would perform the permutation meditations of the Hebrew letters, corresponding them to their source in the Esser Sefirot and the Ten Sefirot, imbuing them with the name of Hashem Yudke Vavke, creating the image above to manifest through the world below. And there is a secret here as to the reason and of the positioning of the body like this. We don't have to get into those details at this time. But this meditative technique is still used to this day. Indeed, one of the great Kabbalistic sages of Italy, Rabbi Menachem Azariah of Fano, even describes a meditative technique wherein which this position of prostration is done under the waters of the mikvah. And indeed, in the essays that I have teaching the meditations of the mikvah, I do include this technique. And I will recommend those of you who are interested to find that material on our website, koshertorah.com. But within this meditative position, this secret position, Eliyahu HaNavi is creating a vessel through his mind, activating it by the power of Hashem. And then he calls to his servant, "Nope, I get it? Not yet, huh?" And he has to go back and do it again with greater depth, with more focus, more detail. Looks up. "How about now? Not yet? All right." Goes back to do it again, over and over, until finally the seventh time. Notice, the clouds did not miraculously all of a sudden appear over their head, but rather the laws of nature are taking effect and the clouds are coming in from over the Mediterranean. Indeed, what Eliyahu HaNavi is doing is using the power of Hashem to create within his mind the visualization of the movement of storm clouds over the Mediterranean, bringing them into the land of Israel. And each and every time he has to focus, creating the image, reinforcing the image, making the image, using my metaphor, so heavy that it falls out of the spiritual realm into the physical to become real. And indeed, the rain comes. Now, it's a very interesting story in the Gemara, which speaks also about the coming of rain. Notice the difference here. I'm going to quote to you here from Gemara Masechet Ta'anit, the story of a very famous Choni. Choni was also one, like Eliyahu HaNavi, a master of the divine names, who, listen to the story, once rain had not fallen, even though most of the month of Adar was over. Remember, in Israel, there are seasonal rains, so it's late. The rains are late in Rains don't come. It's very, very dangerous for an agricultural society. People therefore sent a message to Choni, who was called the circle drawer. Pray for rain. He prayed, no rain came. And then he drew a circle and stood in it. He said, Lord of the universe, your children have turned to me, for I am considered like a member of your household. I hereby swear by your great name, I will not stir from here until you have mercy on your children. A few drops of rain fell. His disciples said to him, Master, it seems that this drizzle has fallen only to fulfill your vow. It's not enough. Choni declared, I did not ask for rain like this, but for rains to fill cisterns, ditches, and caves. Then the rain fell in torrents. His disciples said, you have rain like this, will destroy the world. Choni said, I did not ask for rain like this either, but for rain of benevolence, blessing, and bounty. And then the rain fell normally. Gee, Eliyahu HaNavi has to hear try over and over and over again, and Choni's answered right away. Well, again, remember, the story here of Choni is true, but there are a lot of details left out of it. We have to understand. Choni is called the circle drawer. Why does he draw a circle? As if to say, God, you better listen to me or I'm going to stand here and hold my breath until you do. If anything, Hashem would consider that arrogant until the guy goes stay there until the cows come home. You don't talk to God like that. You don't make conditions to Shemaim. And indeed, Choni did not. Choni was a tzaddik, a kadosh of the highest caliber. He created a circle of separation, of hitbodedut, of isolation, to separate himself from the outside world. And though it said he stood, indeed he was in the prophetic position, and he was able to bring rain, even as did Eliyahu HaNavi. And the reason why this is such an important story is for us to recognize that the power of Eliyahu is not unique. He did pass it on to Elisha, and Elisha to others, and on, until it arrived with Choni. And indeed, it has passed on even beyond that to our day. Moving right along. Eliyahu again says to Ahab, go up, hitch your horses to the chariot and descend, because rains are going to come, you're going to get in trouble. So the heavens grew dark with clouds and wind, and there was a heavy rain. And Ahab rode home to the Jezreel. Now, the spirit of strength from Hashem came with Eliyahu, and he girded his loins, prepared himself for travel, and he ran aside Ahab's chariot all the way to Jezreel. My gosh, you want to talk about jogging 25 miles. Do you realize that a chariot drawn by horses is going maybe 30, 40 miles an hour? And from Mount Carmel to Jezreel, let me tell you something, that's a trip. That's a real trip. And Eliyahu HaNavi was able to keep paces with horses for hours and hours. That is a miracle. But indeed, it proves to us a point. Our sages teach us that in order for one to be a Navi, he had to be strong. Many times, this is interpreted as being strength of character, as it is defined in Pirkei Avot. But indeed, Rambam describes, based upon this episode here, more than strength of character. One had to have strength of body. One had to be physically strong and robust in order to be able to accomplish the prophetic tasks. Indeed, a Navi, to accomplish those things that Hashem would want from him, had to be able to do feats beyond the limitation of what we can possibly imagine. And indeed, this was one of them. It was not something possibly that even Eliyahu normally could do. Remember, Eliyahu was not a young man at this time. But he was able to do it because a spirit of strength from Hashem came upon him. And that is the great secret here, that Eliyahu was able to actualize this. A man who could raise the dead, create something out of nothing, travel by folding space, bringing the rain at will. Very powerful man, would you not say? So then, Ahab, chapter 19, tells Jezebel all that Eliyahu had done, and all that he had killed all of her prophets. And Jezebel sent a messenger down to Eliyahu, of course, was, I guess, in the palace. So may the gods do to me, so-and-so, unless by this is going to happen to you by this time tomorrow. In other words, Jezebel says, you killed all my prophets. Wait until you see what I do to you by this time tomorrow. I will make your life like the life of one of them. Eliyahu saw, and he rose and fled for his life. Fled for his life? Why would he do that? This man of supernatural powers. Because even a man of supernatural powers knows and recognizes that even though you can literally bend the forces of time and space to your will, there are parameters and boundaries to all things. He could have easily called down fire from heaven and struck Jezebel down. But I guess that wasn't what was meant to be. So we learn from this that Eliyahu himself, at this point at least, is still human. And with him, wisdom. He goes and leaves Israel and goes through Judah, through Beersheba. He leaves his servant there and he goes out into the desert, days distance, and hangs out there in the middle of the dunes and goes under a tree and says, all right, Hashem, I'm done. I'm ready to die. Enough now, Hashem, take my soul. I'm not better than my forefathers. And he lay and slept underneath the tree. And a malach, an angel of Hashem, touched him and says, get up and eat. Obviously, it's time to eat. And he looked, and there miraculously at his head was a cake baked on hot coals and a flask of water. Where did that come from? The malach brought it. Who is this malach? Somehow, somewhere, he came out of nowhere and brought food, baked on coals, mind you, hot food, and water with him. Eliyahu, in the flesh as a human being, as able as he is to break the boundaries of time and space, is still nonetheless confided by them, and he has to eat and drink. And again, he lied down, went back to sleep. He was resting. But the angel of Hashem came back, touched him, and says, get up and eat. You have a journey ahead of you. So Eliyahu arose and ate and drank a second time. And here again we see this interesting interaction between physical and superphysical. On the strength of that meal, he went 40 days and 40 nights into the Sinai to Har Horeb, Mount Sinai itself. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he was in Shemayim, did not need food or drink. Here Eliyahu is on the earth, and he is able to go based upon one meal. Now, I've never heard of anyone being able to do this until I came across a teaching in the Chinese tradition that indeed, based upon the pasuk that we say in Torah, not by bread alone does a man live, but by that which comes forth from the mouth of Hashem. Indeed, I don't see a Jewish tradition based upon this, but I do see it in the Chinese tradition. That they have a way that they cultivate people to literally live off life force energy without need for physical sustenance. Literally, they live off the chi. This was the practice of Eliyahu Hanavi. So wherever the Chinese learned it from, we had it first. And this is such a profound point for us. Because what the Torah teaches us, it's not just by the physical consumption of food. It's by the spiritual element within that food that revives our spiritual element, our life force energy within us. And that, more than anything else, is what keeps us alive. Eliyahu HaNavi knew this, and therefore was able to take from within this bread and water, mind you, miraculously brought by a malach, all of its inherent latent spiritual energy, absorb it within him, and it fed him for over a month. He gets to Harav. He goes into a cave to be in isolation, removed from the outside world and concealed from it, so that he can perform his meditative practices without disturbance. And as he does, it says, behold, the word of Hashem comes to him and says to him, what are you doing here, Eliyahu? Malacha po, why are you here? And Eliyahu says, I've been zealous for Hashem, the God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, they've torn down your altars, they've killed your prophet by the sword, and I remain alone. And me they want to kill too. And Hashem says, leave this place. Go out and stand in the mountain before Hashem. Why? Behold, Hashem passes, and a great and strong wind splitting mountains and shattering boulders before Hashem. But Hashem was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. Not in the earthquake was Hashem. And after the earthquake, fire. Not in the fire was Hashem. And after the fire, a still, small voice. And as Elijah heard, he wrapped his face in the mantle and he went out, stood at the entrance of the cave. Behold, a voice came to him and said, what are you doing here, Eliyahu? What is all of this about? What is this wind? What is the earthquake? What is the fire? These are secrets of the prophetic meditative system. Eliyahu was completely removed from the world. He was in a state of absolute isolation, mentally and physically. He could have easily at that moment left his body and gone above. But Hashem said to him, no, come out of the cave. Leave this place. Come back into your body. And then he experienced these bizarre phenomena. The wind, the earthquake, and the fire. We find a similar experience to this with Ezekiel and his experience of the Merkavah chariot that opens up the story of his book. Our teachers teach us that these wind, earthquake, and fire are actually metaphors for different phases of consciousness that the prophet must go through in order to get to the level to hear that voice of Hashem within. Let's digress and explain this. I have an essay on this material in my book, Call Upon My Name, Yikra B'Shmi. And I am presently editing that essay, and God be willing, should have it available on our website, koshertorah.com, in the near future. Understand now that in order for the human mind to accomplish this super ability of bonding with the spirit of Hashem and using elements of meditation and a visualization to create an alteration of physical reality, the mind must first go through some alterations of its own. When we're thinking, even now at this moment, our minds are rushing around, racing around. Our minds are literally focusing on one thing and another and then another and then another, and we're never really thinking about any one thing for any long amount of time. Our eyes, our ears are always moving back and forth. And with it, our attention, and if you will, our consciousness, follows suit. We are flittering around like a butterfly. Or, if you will, like a big wind, pushing us from one way to another, breaking rocks, causing all kinds of disturbances. Hashem is not in the wind. The first step of any meditative state must be to silence the mind. And this is accomplished by focusing the mind, to allowing the mind to stay tuned to one specific thing. And this is why the meditation and recitation of letters with vowels helps the mind focus on a singularity. The ultimate singularity, of course, being Hashem. But once the mind does accomplish this focus of singularity, which I assure you is not an easy task, all of a sudden now that the conscious mind is focused, matters arise from the unconscious mind, and like an earthquake, they shake you up. They try to break your attention and your focus. Many people lose it at this time because they can't get beyond what's like an inner barrier, that whenever they quiet their mind, something from within rumbles from within. This indeed requires of one to make peace with one's own unconscious mind, and to be properly, emotionally, and psychologically balanced. In the Hebrew, this is a term called hishtavut, translated often as equanimity, but let us translate it as balanced. Properly, emotionally, peace, in which one's heart and mind are at one. And when one achieves this level of inner peace, of true inner satisfaction with oneself, every now and then, like a laser beam, a penetrating fire just burns at you, crashes into your mind, how unworthy you are, how little you are, how impossible the task is. Even though you are at peace with yourself, you can never approach God. This too, Hashem is not in. This too is a klipa, a husk, a shell, a falsehood, which must be gone beyond. And indeed, once these states have been passed, and you're now in a position to be a vessel, a vehicle, a Merkava, for Hashem, indeed, the communication occurs. But it is not in a loud voice spoken from heaven with a booming sound like a microphone. It's a still, soft voice. It speaks within the back of your mind. And let me explain it to you. Let's say you and I are having a conversation, and we're talking about something serious, so you're really paying attention. Someone else comes up from behind you and says something to you. You're paying attention to me. You didn't really pay attention to what that other person said. You heard what they said, but you didn't like really hear it. You weren't like paying attention to it, but you heard it anyway. You can turn back to that person and say, "Did I just hear you say such and such?" Of course, the person would say yes. Here, the situation is similar. When you hear this voice of Hashem within you, it's like an echo. It's like you hear it, but you don't hear it. It's like a bolt of lightning, which is there and gone in an instant. And you go, what was that? And indeed, this is what Eliyahu Navi experienced. He had that connection that came to him. Now, he already had it in the depth of the cave. Why did he have to go through this again? Because there, his reception was facing up. Here, the reception was coming down. In other words, he gave his gripe to Hashem, and Hashem said, "I don't want to hear it within isolation. You are my prophet. You are my messenger. You are my hand in the universe. You are my hand through which I act upon the earth. I need you in the world. Go out to the world. The metaphor of leaving the cave. And of course, then Eliyahu had to go through the process of the transformations of consciousness. And the still voice thus comes to him and says to him again, Malachapo, what are you doing here? Six simple letters. And then Eliyahu answers exactly as he said before. I've been zealous for Hashem, the God of hosts, the children of Israel, forsaken you, your covenant, tore down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword. I alone remain, and they seek to take my soul too. So what does Hashem says? Hashem says to him, be comforted, my prophet. I am with you. He doesn't say anything of the kind. This is Eliyahu Navi. He doesn't need to be comforted. Hashem says to him, go back to the desert of Damascus. Go up to Syria. I want you to go up there and anoint Hazael to be king over Aram, which is Syria. And Yehu, the son of Nishmi, you shall anoint to be king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shavat from Abel Moloch, you shall anoint to be a prophet in your stead. You want out? I'll get you out. But there are things you have to do first. And the prophecy then states, those who escape the sword of Hazael, Yehu will kill. Those who escape the sword of Yehu, Elisha will kill. And I will leave over in Israel 7,000, all knees that did not kneel to the Baal, and every mouth that did not kiss him. Eliyahu, you're not alone. And of course, the Midrash now teaches us, based upon this experience, that Hashem says to him, because you thought that you were alone, I will show you how not true that is. And every time when a Jewish child is brought into the covenant of Avraham Avinu, you will be there to bear witness to this event. And so we metaphorically teach that Eliyahu is at each and every Brit, right? Wrong. Eliyahu is not metaphorically there. He is there. We say that Eliyahu Navi comes to Pesach, right? Metaphorically. No. He is there. Well, I don't see him. Oh, as if that would make any difference. Eliyahu is a consciousness, a mind far beyond the limitations of human flesh, and can be in simultaneous places, simultaneous times, simultaneously. He can be there because Hashem has enabled him to be such, and indeed he is there. And that is why we create a place of honor for him, because somehow, in some way, an element of his consciousness does imbue that place. And it is real. Moving right along. Eliyahu moves forward and goes from there. He finds Elisha, the son of Shaphat, and he's plowing the field. He's got 12 yokes before him, and he's with the 12th. And Eliyahu goes over to him and throws his mantle on top of him. And that's a symbol of, come, you're my son. Elisha immediately understood. And he left his ox and he ran after Eliyahu and says, wait, let me say goodbye to my mom and dad, and I'm going to go right away with you. And Eliyahu apparently is a little upset, and he goes, come, return. What have I done? I'm not making you leave anything. Go do whatever you want. But Eliyahu went back with them. They took the yoke of oxen, they slaughtered them with the gear of the oxen, they cooked the meat, and they gave to the people, and they ate. And then he arose and followed after Eliyahu and ministered. This is a great calling. The life of Elisha is indeed only second to Eliyahu himself. But here, Eliyahu, when he calls to Elisha, and Elisha says, you know, I have practical obligations and responsibilities to do. Eliyahu says to him, I didn't tell you not to do them, did I? I didn't say, forget about reality, did I? And indeed, this is a very important point that we must always remember. We have discussed a lot of very powerful and profound spiritual things here. We've talked about the necessity of isolation, removal, and people so possessed and have a desire to walk the path of the prophetic Kabbalah would think, I'm getting rid of everything I have, I'm going to go move into a cave and bond with God. Well, no, you're not. And no, you should not. There's an old saying, it's not a Jewish saying, but it should be, that you can become so heavenly minded that you become no earthly good. And this is a great danger when it comes to the practice of this type of lifestyle. And this is why our sages emphatically teach us Kabbalah, not so much the reading of the Kitvei Ari, the Zohar, but the real practice of the real stuff, should only be done by people, men, women too, who are older in years. 40 is a good year, good age. Person has to be married, have to have some means of physical support, in other words, grounded in the real world. A person of responsibility and obligation. A person of realistic insight and understanding of the nature of the world. Because you can go off thinking, oh, in my mind I can create all these powers. And you can go off into your mind and totally divorce yourself from the realities of life. And you can become psychotic. And our sages have warned us that some people who study Kabbalah can go mad. Believe you me, when they say that, they know what they're talking about. Not everybody can walk this path. This path requires the greatest amount of discipline and the razor's edge of living in this world and at the same time living in a world beyond this world. And many people who walk the razor's edge only end up cutting their feet because it requires wisdom, discipline, devotion, commitment, all those dirty words that people don't like to hear today, even in our many sins in the firm world. It is a hard path to walk, one that Eliyahu knew well and apparently taught well to Elisha. Now, although some people can state, you know, you're allowed to study Kabbalah from the age of 20. Yeah, that's true. The Ramak, Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, said that. Indeed, Rabbi Avadia Yosef brings that down as Yechavedat. I even hold like that. But I and they are talking about the study, not the practice. There's a big difference between the two. So those who think that they are ready for the practice, let me share with you a personal story with my teacher, Rabbi Meir Levi Alav Shalom. We were once studying some Kabbalistic meditations, and I learned them well. My teacher even complimented me that I learned them quick and well. And I proudly said to him, so now I'm ready to do them. My poor Rebbe coughed. I thought, good gosh, he was going to die. I almost killed my Rebbe. That's a terrible thing to do. He looks at me and he said, what are you, nuts? You don't even know the first step yet. I was so confused. I said, but Rebbe, you just taught me everything. What am I missing? He didn't answer me. And it took me maybe 10 years, 10 long years, before it finally dawned on me from within what he was talking about. And when that insight came to me, I said, I understand now. And it's not an understanding that you can get from a book. It's not an understanding you can learn by words. It is something that takes the process of the psychological transformation that you must make as a human on your way to becoming a malach, or if you will, in the image of Adam before the fall. And I can't put this into words for you. I can't put it into a book for you. This is something experiential. It would kind of like me trying to describe to you the intimacy felt between a husband and a wife. I can write all the books, I can describe to you all the things and give you all the pictures. But the essence of the feeling cannot be passed over like that. So it is with this experience. Heed what I say to you. Because as we know, not everyone who has or has accomplished psychic powers indeed is a true servant of Hashem. One can pursue the path of the prophet and indeed accomplish some means of psychic release. But this means nothing. Indeed, in the Torah itself, in the book of Deuteronomy, in the 13th chapter, Hashem says, if there stands up in your midst a prophet, a dreamer of dreams, he produces for you a sign or a wonder, meaning he knows how to do it. And the sign of the wonder comes about. And then he says, let's go follow gods of others that you did not know. Don't be so impressed and overwhelmed by these signs and say, this is a guy who has evolved. He has the power of the mind. He can manifest all of these things. I guess what he says is true. Let's go follow him. On the contrary, he says here in the Torah, do not hearken to the words of that prophet or dreamer. Hashem is testing you to know whether you love Hashem with all your heart and with all your soul. And then you shall take someone like this and put him to death. Wow, that's rather radical. And indeed it is. But here now is the great secret. When one cultivates psychic powers that enable the mind to manipulate time and space, I'm sorry to have to say this is not limited to one who has Kedusha. The spirit of Hashem, a spark of it, can in essence be captured, kidnapped, and used by what's called the Sitra Achra, the other side, the dark side, and used to create artificial light. We speak about the seven Sephirot of the world of Atzilut, which fell because they were not in a proper alignment position to receive their light above. I've discussed this metaphor and teachings in many other places, in writing and in tape that you can find on koshertorah.com. I'm not going to digress and get into that right now. But the order of the fallen Sephirot meaning the energies which can be abused because they are not in proper alignment with their source above, are seven in number, one on top of the other. And indeed, that is the image of the Sephirot of the dark side. It is also the image of seven energy forms, which in the Eastern tradition are called chakras. And I know all too many people from the side of holiness who endeavor to pursue a relationship with chakras without realizing that just by their nature, they are in essence the Sitra Achra, the dark Sephirot, the imitation of the real, but not the truth. And I have always warned people to stay away from that essence and element of Kundalini, because it will open you up to forces which will not come from Hashem, but forces that will draw you to the side of evil. And they do exist. But now, this is the danger. It existed very prominently in the days of the First Temple. And it was with the destruction of the temple and the removal of the Ark of the Covenant that prophecy also was hidden, so that the dangers could not be pursued to the point that they were before. And granted, prophecy has indeed ceased from the children of Israel. But there's a very interesting pasuk that the Navi Amos writes. And he says, for Hashem Elohim, quoting from the second parak here, will not do anything unless he has revealed his secret to his servants, the prophets. A lion has roared, who shall not fear? Hashem Elohim has spoken, who will not prophesy? Now, understand now a great secret. Though we have no prophecy today because the vessel and vehicle of prophecy has passed, the method and techniques to become a prophet have not passed. And indeed, many people embrace them, learn them well, and practice them. And they are always among us, concealed, secret, just like Eliyahu in the depths of the cave, isolated by ways of heat bodidut. You will not find them, you will not know them, but they are there. Simple Jews, from, maybe not with a black hat on, maybe not even with a beard. And they do what they have to do. They are as if Hashem's prophets today. And they know what it is that Hashem is to do. And indeed, he reveals things to them. Prior to the Holocaust, World War II, a group of sages simultaneously had an insight. I don't want to call it a vision, we'll just say an insight, of what was to come. And these simultaneous experiences were with people separated by thousands of miles. They communicated with one another via telephone, via telegram, letter, and they all confirmed with one another what they all knew. The Holocaust was coming. Indeed, to this day, Hashem communicates with his servants. Moving right along. In the 21st parak in Malachim here, there's a whole section of different things in the 20th chapter of different wars and things. They don't relate to Eliyahu himself, so I'm skipping them. I want to stay focused on Eliyahu and Avi. In the 21st parak, Ahav sees a field which is owned by a gentleman named Naboth, a vineyard actually. And he wants to buy it. And Naboth doesn't want to sell. So, Jezebel's wife says to him, "Dear Jezebel, the evil one, why don't you exercise your kingly power, right?" And what he does is this. Jezebel creates a scenario where she's going to steal Naboth's field. She wrote letters in Ahab's name, sealed them with his seal, which I guess the queen had access to the elders of the city where Naboth lived. And she says, proclaim a fast, and Naboth has to sit up with the leaders of the people, and I'm going to send two lying spies. And they're going to testify and say that Naboth cursed God and the king. And the minute the people hear that, with two witnesses, the law states you're going to go out and stone him to death. How dare he do such a thing? And indeed, that's what Jezebel did. She set him up. Naboth died by the lies of this evil woman. And then Jezebel went and says to Ahab, you know, hey, Naboth's dead. What do you think about that? Go take his field. And Ahab does it. He wasn't really part of this plan, but he took advantage of it. And now Eliyahu Hanavi comes back. Where Hashem says to Eliyahu, go down to Ahav. He's in Samaria now. He's in Naboth's vineyard. He's taking possession of it. And this is what you're going to say to him. Thus says Hashem. You have murdered and you've inherited, have you? You inherited this field, didn't you? And you shall speak to him, Hashem says. Thus says Hashem. In the place that the dogs have licked the blood of Naboth, shall the dogs lick your blood, even yours. And Ahab turns to Eliyahu and says, oh, my enemy, and I see you found me. And you've said, I have found you because you have sold yourself to do what is bad in the eyes of Hashem. I will bring disaster upon you, and I will expunge after you, and I will cut off from Ahab every male child, and those who are restrained, and those that are free in Israel. And I will make your house as the house of Jeroboam, etc., and so on, because you have angered Hashem, and you've caused Israel to sin. And concerning Jezebel, Hashem spoke, saying, the dogs will eat her in the valley of Jezreel. The dead of Ahav in the city will be eaten by the dogs, and the dead of the field, the fowls of the sky will eat. And there was none like Ahav who had sold himself to do bad in the eyes of Hashem, who surrendered himself to a bad woman, that Jezebel, his wife, instigated him. And he had done every abominability with idols, like those of the Amorites who had done. And thus ends the prophecy. In other words, Hashem says, you're just too bad. Out you go. And here, it is clearly documented that Ahav was guided badly by his wife, the Phoenician princess. And here our sages teach us something very important. It is the nature of a wife to be able to direct the direction of her husband. Indeed, the Gemara gives us an example of a couple who were righteous and they did not have a child. So by the laws applicable at that time, they divorced. And he, a righteous man, married a wicked woman. Whereas she, a righteous woman, married a wicked man. The wicked woman turned the heart of her righteous husband and made him wicked. Whereas the righteous woman turned the wicked heart of her wicked husband and made him righteous. The life of a man, the heart of a man, is in the hands of his wife. And so it was with Ahav. Now remember, as we learned before, Ahav wasn't a hater of Hashem. He was just a weak man who allowed too much compromise. This concludes this recording. Please go to the next one now.